to read a few verses from Exodus chapter 23, which will hopefully help us to think about some of the issues around harvest and the world that we live in today. Exodus 23, starting at verse 10 and reading down just to verse 13. For 6 years you are to sow your fields and harvest the crops, but during the seventh year let the land lie unploughed and unused. Then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they leave. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days do your work, but on the seventh day do not work, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the slave born in the household and the alien as well may be refreshed. Be careful to do everything I have said to you. Do not invoke the names of other gods. Do not let them be heard on your lips. We'll stop there. It's just four short verses, and yet it is such an important four verses in the Bible, because it establishes, first of all, the principle of a day's rest every week for us, which followed the pattern that God had established whenever he created the world, working for 6 days and then taking a day's rest. And what God is saying here is, I know that I needed to have that day's rest after the work of creation, and you need it too. But the passage goes further than just saying have a day's rest each week, because in fact before it gets to that, it starts off, for 6 years you're to sow your fields and harvest the crops, but during the seventh year let the land lie unploughed and unused. And so it's establishing, not just in this short passage, the principle of one day off from work each week, but it's establishing the same principle for the land, 1 year off each week, or each 7 years, that you're to have the land recover. But if we go into another part of the book of Leviticus, and into, can't find the, where I was, I can't find here where I am. Sorry, I made it to Leviticus. We see in the, elsewhere in Scripture that the land is to lie fallow for a year, and we're told that it's the poor among your people that they may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they leave. And the idea is that as we sow our crops, as we plant our vineyards, as we do all these things with the land, that in the year which is left, in the seventh year, after 6 years, then the land, there will still be some seeds that have fallen in the land, there will still be other uses for the land, for the animals and so on, but we're not to use them, we're to let the land lie fallow. And that's a principle that has gone down through many ages, and farmers have found that it's a good principle to follow. The principle that the land needs a rest, just as we do. For us it's one day and seven, for the land. it's 1 year and seven. I remember as a teenager reading this and thinking that must be awful hard on the people, because here we are, they'd worked for 6 years and then they'd have a year and they weren't working the land then, and where were they going to get their food from? What was going to happen in that seventh year? How were they going to survive? And then I realized that this was given to the people before they would go into the promised land. And when they would go into the promised land, you'd start to establish your farm or your vineyard or whatever it was that you had. And maybe in the first year, you'd be able to just clear a small field. And so you'd clear that small field. And the second year, your field that was cleared the first year was, it didn't take as much work, so you were able to clear a second field as well. And then the third year, you had the first two that you'd done, and they didn't need so much work, so you'd work into the third field, and so on, until you got to the sixth year. And then the first field that you'd done, you'd worked it for 6 years, but now you've got six fields. So your seventh year, you let that field, the first field, lie fallow, and you develop your seventh field, and so you'd have a rotation of seven fields. And I believe that it's better for the land to be, maybe the farmers will tell me that I'm wrong, but I think I'm right in saying that it's better for crops to be rotated through fields so that they're not used in the same way all the time and take up all the nutrients, or one particular nutrient, but the crops are rotated through. Obviously, in our day, with fertilisers and different things, then maybe that is not so important, that the crops are rotated in that way and all the goodness kept in the soil. But there is a principle here that God asks us as people, God asks humanity, to give the land a rest for 1 year and seven. It wasn't just that the land would be refreshed. It wasn't just to give the land a time to regenerate, to recover. If we turn over into Exodus, or if we look on and in Exodus 23, verse 11, it says that there's another reason for it. It says, then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they leave. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. And here God is establishing this principle that not only does the land need a rest, but there will be some crops that will grow because that's the nature of things. There will be some crops that will grow on that field, and you're to leave it so that, and here's the thing, so that the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they leave. And so God can see that in the society that's going to develop in the promised land, that there will be poor. There will be those who are on the margins of society. It's not just a new thing. It's not just something that's happening in our days. This was happening all those years ago back when the children of Israel were still walking through the wilderness before they got to the promised land. And God is giving them these instructions so that when they go into the promised land, not only would they look after the land itself, but they would look after those who, for whatever reason, whether because they've mismanaged their own fields or their money, or because they've fallen on hard times and they're not able to farm and look after their fields, that they will be provided for as well. God cares for men and women, boys and girls, the people. God also cares also prayers for the plants that are in the fields. He prayers for the entire creation. If you go over into Leviticus now, in chapter 23 and verse 22, we see another principle here. It's a principle that is not just for 1 year and seven, but for every year. And as we thought, if a farmer had fields and if he managed his land divided up into seven different plots, then each year there would be one plot which was left fallow, but there'd be six that would be grown. That would mean that he would have a harvest every year. And here in Leviticus 23, verse 32, or the verses leading up to verse 32, it says, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field, or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God. When you reap, when you go to take the produce out of your field, you're not to go right to the edges. And it's, isn't it our nature almost to go, not to go, or to go right to the edges? Driving up Sun Street this week, you may have noticed that there's a tree missing. We have a tree cut down, big beech tree, cut down out of the house, which, for different reasons. But one of the things that I wanted whenever we got the tree cut down was the wood. We've got a wood burner, so I thought, I'm going to have them crack this wood away. I'll keep it, I'll chop it up, I'll put it in the wood burner. And the guy who was cutting the wood down, he said, "No, I'll cut it into logs for you and so on. And I'll throw the rest away." And I looked at some of the stuff he's with. I said, "Oh, I could use that stuff." So I went out and I got my shears and my clippers and stuff. And I was, "Oh, I'll take the small stuff as well because that will help me get the fire started. They're not going to start it with big logs." And I was determined to get the best use of food out of all this wood that was being cut down from our beech tree. And I think that's our natural instinct, is to try and get the best value for money, if you like, or best value out of the land. But here, Scripture says to the Israelites, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges. And do not gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and the foreigner residing among you. Why would we do that? Well, if we turn over again now into the book of Ruth, and here we see the outworking of this command. You may remember that Ruth had two daughters, and one went back to her own land, and the other stayed with their own land of Moab, and the other stayed with Naomi, her mother-in-law. And they came, and they were struggling. They were refugees in the land of Israel. And in Ruth chapter 2, and verse 2, it says, "And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor.'" And here, she's in the fields of Boaz, and Boaz was allowing people to go in after the people, after his workers had sought to get all the grain that they could. And Boaz was allowing these people to go into his fields and to pick up what was left over, what his workers had missed. As we live in the UK today, for me, these verses are very challenging, because in our society today, and as I've just said about myself and our beech tree, we want to get the most out of everything. We want to get to work everything the hardest that we can. And they may be speaking also to the political chaos in our land at the minute. There's, as we all know, two different opinions as to what way our land should go. Should we go in the way of leaving the EU or staying in the EU? And I'm not going to make any political points, but we see here that God has a care for the foreigner, and he recognised that there were foreigners in the land. And he recognised that they needed to be looked after just as much as the people who were in the land. Maybe they came because there was conflict elsewhere and they had to move because of conflict. Maybe they came because there was drought elsewhere and they had to move because of drought and their crops had failed. But maybe they came just because they were lazy and they thought they'd go and see what they could find elsewhere. Maybe they thought the grass was greener on the other side of the fence, as we say. But for whatever reason, even in biblical times, even in the time that the Book of Ruth was written, there was people who were in need, and there was people who needed care and help. And Boaz was a man who obviously knew his scriptures and who allowed Ruth, Naomi's daughter-in-law Ruth, to go into the field and to glean the field so that she could provide for her mother-in-law and herself. God cares for the foreigner, God cares for the refugee as well. In our own small way in Stranraer, we're beginning to grasp the implications of this in 2019, the implications of these commands and principles. We're part of the Rins Church's Basics Bank, where we can give produce each week to the Basics Bank to help people who are in food poverty. In this very hall tomorrow morning, maybe 30 or 40 people will gather to be fed because they're in poverty, because they don't have enough money to give them 3 square meals a day. Over the last half-term break, Dumfries and Galloway Council established a programme where children who were no longer getting school meals, which were their main food for the day, could receive food from the school, and the Fed Up Cafe were involved in providing that here in Stranraer, as were others, groups throughout Dumfries and Galloway. We live in a time where, just as Ruth and Naomi had to seek food, seek the gleanings, that the leftovers for food for themselves, so it's the same in ours, even in our time today. There are poor and homeless in our society. Three groups like Fed Up Cafe, Women's Aid, Food Bank, and other initiatives, we have the opportunity maybe sometimes to our shame, the church, who should be taking these principles from Scripture and heralding them and championing them and applying them. Maybe we are some of the slower ones to get involved. Though I have heard of a situation where somebody was looking for food in the town just in the past couple of weeks, and they went to one church and they were told, no, we don't do that. Go to a different church. And eventually they ended up here, and Daniel happened to be here, and we were able to provide a food parcel for them. It can be messy. The people who are in this situation can be rough and ready, but we don't know the lives that they have had to live. They may have made mistakes themselves. They may have done things in their life which we would say, well, if you hadn't done that, you wouldn't be in that situation, and maybe they wouldn't. But they did do it, and they are in that situation. And God calls us to act and to love them and to show them compassion. In the story of the feeding of the 5,000, we see Jesus' extravagant provision for them. Here was a crowd of people who had been following him, and they were miles away from anywhere. And the disciples said, Lord, send them away so that they can get to the shops before they close, so that they'll be able to buy food for themselves. But what did Jesus do? Jesus, we read in Mark chapter 6, said, we're told he had compassion on them. And he answered the disciples when they said, send the people away because it's already late. He said to them, you give them something to eat. Can you imagine being the disciples at that time and being told by Jesus, give them something to eat? Well, they came up with some fish and loaves. But there's 5,000 people. How was that going to work? How were they going to manage? But we know the story that Jesus took the fish and he took the bread and he broke it and he just kept breaking it. And as he broke it, more bread appeared in his hands, and it was a miracle. And we don't know exactly what happened. But what we do know is that they all left fully satisfied, and there were 12 baskets left over. And I don't think it's insignificant that there were 12 baskets left over. All the crowd had gone. They'd been satisfied. And there's 12 baskets sitting there. And Jesus is sitting there with his 12 disciples. And I'm quite sure that Jesus gave each of the disciples one of the baskets and said, here, take that home. Not because you need the food, not because you need the fish and the bread. But take it home as a reminder to you of the extravagant generosity of God. That when we bring God into the equation, anything is possible. I think sometimes I, and maybe you as Christians, don't see the extravagant goodness of God because we're too busy providing for ourselves. We work the extra hours to get the extra money to give us that extra little bit that we want. But what do we miss out on those extra, working those extra hours? Do we miss the church prayer meeting? Do we miss time with our kids? Do we miss the chance to get together with our mates and just have a chat and some friendship? ourselves drive us to all this getting and getting and getting. And because we do that and we seek to get things for ourselves, do we forget that all that we have comes from God? And do we also forget that our God is an extravagant God? A God who loves to give. He didn't just stop whenever he'd broken the bread and the fish and say, right, that's you all fed. I can stop a miracle now. He kept going and gave more and more than they needed. And God will do the same for us. God is an extravagant God. I read a story this week, and if my Kindle works, I want to read it to you. It's a true story. It's in a book called Love Does by a man called Bob Goff. And the story, as you will hear, just tells of a young lad who asked a stranger for something. And when he got that, he got the courage to ask for a little more and a little more. And I think it's a lesson that we could all do with learning. That when we come to God, are we too afraid to ask God for the really big things? So we just keep asking him for little things. Here's the story. Bob Goff writes, "We have a house down by the water, and there's a little grass path where couples hold hands and walk along the bay front. My wife and I sit on the back porch and hold hands a lot too, as we watch couples meander by. We're close enough to the water that they wave to us, and we wave back. Nostalgic snippet from another time where people waved to each other during slow walks. This is how I met Ryan. One day Ryan came walking down the path all alone. Ryan waved to us and we waved back, like we do to everyone. But instead of moving on, Ryan just stood there on the path, waving and not moving. Because he kept waving, we kept waving. It was a little awkward, honestly. I wondered if perhaps this young man wanted to talk, so to break the tension, I made the short walk from the porch to the path to say, hello. Hi there, how's it going? I said, reaching out to shake his hand and give him a break from all the waving. Hi, I'm Ryan, and I'm in love, he said confidently. Ryan had that glazed over look that smitten guys get. Well, Ryan, that's just great. Congratulations, I said. No, no, that's not why I came, Ryan stammered. What I wanted to say is that I walk by your house all the time, and I have this girlfriend, you see, and, he paused, I want to know if it would be okay. He paused again. If I ask my girlfriend to marry me in your backyard. He talked like he'd been holding his breath for quite some time. I was taken aback by this love-glazed kid who would approach a complete stranger and ask to use his house to stage a great caper. But that's the way it is when you're in love, isn't it? All he knew was that he wanted the girl and was going to do whatever it took to get her. Ryan, that sounds like a fantastic idea, I said, laughing. Really? Ryan answered. I guess he'd expected an instant no, or a gentler, I'll think about it. Sure, go get your girl and let you two get engaged. With that, Ryan went half skipping, half floating down the grassy path. I think his feet hit the path about every 20 feet or so. He was being strategic. He was being audacious. He knew what he was going to do. He was going to get his girl. A few days later, we were sitting on the back porch again. Couples were walking down the path holding hands. We would wave to them and they would wave to us. Then came an animated figure bouncing and waving happily with both arms. It didn't take long for me to figure out that it was Ryan. And I walked down to the path to greet him. "Hi," Ryan yelped, with his wonderfully goofy, glazed over, "I'm in love" grin. "Hi, Ryan, what can I do for you?" "Well, you know how I'm going to propose in your backyard?" "Yes, I remembered that." "I was wondering if you would think it would be possible for us..." He did another Ryan pause, so I knew whatever followed would be a whopper. "To have dinner on your back porch before I popped the question." I bit my tongue to keep from laughing out loud. I'd never even met Ryan before that week, and now he was asking if he could have a marriage proposal and dinner on my back porch. This kid has it bad. After a short pause, I shot back to young Ryan. "What the heck? Of course you can have dinner on my porch, Ryan. That's a great idea. What can I make for you?" I didn't think he heard the question, because off went Ryan down the path. He seemed to be levitating. He may have touched down in the grass once or twice over the next 100 yards. Ryan was another step closer to the prize. He was all in. He was all about doing and not just dreaming. He was going to get the girl. By now, I found myself looking forward to my afternoon encounters with young Ryan. It reminded me how fun it was to be young and in love. I even started coming home early from work to sit on the back porch waiting for him, checking my watch every 5 minutes or so, wondering when he would have come bouncing down the path with another outlandish request for a total stranger. And sure enough, Ryan came bounding down the path again, so I went down to greet him. "Hey, Bob, hey, I was thinking..." And then the pregnant pause. "Would it be possible for me to have some friends of mine serve us when we're having dinner on your porch?" "You bet," I shot back laughing. I was already this far in with Ryan. What could it hurt to have a few of his friends over? "What a great idea. How many would it take to serve you to dinner?" Ryan looked up with a Cheshire Cat grin and sheepishly said, 20. Did he just say 20? 20 people inside my house to be his servers? I was wonderfully stunned by the consistently audacious, almost vertical trajectory of Ryan's plans. He wanted 20 people to serve a dinner for two. Now that's service. But when love does it big. "What a great idea, Ryan. 20 it is," I said without hesitation. Ryan bounced away down the bayfront. I could tell that his head was ready to explode with anticipation. He had the vision, he had the plan, he had the place, and he had the staff. He was trigger locked on the goal, and he was going to get that girl. A few days later, I was at my post. Almost on cue, Ryan came galloping down the path. "Ryan, how are the plans coming?" "Well," he said, "I was actually wondering if it would be okay if, after dinner and after my friends leave, we could put some speakers on the porch and maybe we could dance a bit." Of course you want to dance on the stranger's porch. "Speakers it is," I told him. "Anything else?" I was trying to get all the possibilities out of him now. "Well, I think that about covers it for now. I'll ask her to marry me after we dance for a bit." "Great idea," I said to Ryan. "Go get that girl." Ryan skipped off. A day or two passed with no Ryan sightings. I almost felt a low-grade depression sinking in on me. Was the planning over? Were there no more whimsical and outrageous ideas from Ryan as he planned his caper? Was the mischief done? I sat on my porch, reflecting on how contagious Ryan's brand of love was. And then, almost on cue, Ryan came running down the pathway again. this point, Ryan was a regular, and he bounded across the lawn and up to the porch without hesitation. He was pretty winded, actually, leaning over his hands on his knees, trying to catch his breath. I wondered if I should give him a paper bag to breathe into. After a few long moments, Ryan straightened up. There was a pause while our stares met. I had learnt that a pause by Ryan meant there was another whopper of an idea brewing in his head. "Hey, Ryan, what's up? It's great to see you. How are the plans coming?" "Do you," he exhaled, "have," he inhaled, "a boat?" "A boat?" I was belly laughing as I asked him to repeat what I thought he'd just said. "Yeah, do you have a boat?" Ryan asked more confidently as he straightened a bit. "Well, actually, Ryan, I do," I said with half enthusiasm and half awe at Ryan's love-induced audacious bender. He had that glazed look again as he looked me squarely in the eyes. "Well, can I borrow it?" Ryan was out of control. He had no idea what an outrageous thing he was asking. But you see, to Ryan, I wasn't a total stranger. No one was. To him, the whole world was full of co-conspirators when it came to winning over his love. He was completely unaware of and unimpeded by what was proper, what was acceptable, and what was conventional. Nothing was going to get in the way of what he decided he was going to do. "Okay, Ryan, the boat's yours," I said. "I'll take you and your girlfriend out in my boat after dinner at my house, after your 20 friends finish serving you, and after you dance together on my porch. You can pop the question to your girl up in the front deck of my boat." Ryan floated away once again, clueless of the beautiful ridiculousness this girl was bringing out of him. Ryan was a study in focus, tenacity, and abandon. He was all gas and no break. What Ryan didn't realise is that I decided to one-up him. Why should he have all the fun? That night I called the Coast Guard and told them about Ryan's elaborate plan and his glazed-over enthusiasm for his girl, which had swept him into a state of unparalleled whimsy. Ryan's enthusiasm was contagious, and pretty soon the guy on the other end of the phone caught the bug too. The Coast Guard officer and I hatched a plan of our own. When the big night came, everything was in place. The night was balmy, the air was clear, and I think the stars even came out a few minutes early to see Ryan's elaborate scheme unfold. Ryan and his girl came walking down the path. When they got to the white Nantucket house on the bay, he led her up the stairs and across the lawn toward a candlelit table in the porch. "Ryan, what are we doing? Is this okay? Whose house is this?" she whispered as she held his arm a little tighter. Ryan pulled out her chair and said this was for her as he sat her down. The service at dinner by the 20 servers was impeccable. The after-dinner dance was endearing as those two stood with arms around each other, slowly moving together on the porch. As they danced, they twirled and talked quietly. By now, evening had fully set in and the lights of the city mixed with the stars were starting to dominate the skyline. It was as if the early appearing stars had gone home and invited all of their friends, telling them, "You've got to see this." The evening was coming to its natural end, and Ryan took his girl by the hand, and they headed back to the path. I've always wondered what was going through her head during all this. I hope it all felt like a dream. As they got closer to the dock behind the house, Ryan gripped her hand, turned and took her toward a boat that was tied to the end. "Ryan, what are we doing?" "Come on," is all he had to say as they came onto my boat. I was at the helm and they made their way to the bow. With the stars out in full view, we slowly motored out into the bay. After a short time, we approached the spot where Ryan and I agreed I would stop the boat so he could pop the question. In a total coup de grace, Ryan had 50 more of his friends on the shore to spell out, "Will you marry me?" with candles, just in case he got tongue-tied or overwhelmed in the intensity and whimsy of the moment. With their flickering sign as his backdrop, Ryan got on one knee. "Will?" he exhaled. "You?" this special moment of their lives, neither Ryan nor his bride-to-be noticed that the Coast Guard had pulled in behind us with the firefighting boat, just as the officer and I had planned. I gave the thumbs up, the sign said that she said yes, and he shot off every water cannon he had in the entire rig. It was a scene that belonged to New York Harbor on the 4th of July, with the Statue of Liberty in the background. But it wasn't happening there. It was happening for Ryan, because that's the way love rolls. It multiplies. Ryan and his bride-to-be let the mist from the water cannons settle over them like a thousand small kisses. Ryan's love was audacious. It was whimsical. It was strategic. Most of all, it was contagious. Watching Ryan lose himself in love reminded me that being engaged isn't just an event that happens when a guy gets on one knee and puts a ring on his true love's finger. Being engaged is a way of doing life, a way of living and loving. It's about going to extremes and expressing bright hope that life offers us, a hope that makes us brave and expels darkness with light. That's what I want my life to be all about. Full of abandon, whimsy, and in love. I want to be engaged to life and with life. I don't know if God was a bit like Ryan when he created everything, but I find that the kind of love Jesus talked about, the love that never grows tired or is completely finished, finding ways to fully express itself. I love that story. I love the enthusiasm, the infection of it. And I hope that as we think about all that God has given to us, and we give thanks for our harvest, we will also think not just of ourselves, but of others. Of others that we can help, faraway places, as we've heard from Isabel, but also of others in our time that we can help. And that we're not bound by what we think, but that we can get that sense of what Ryan had, that if you just ask, if you push the door open, maybe sometimes the reason why we don't see great things happening is because we don't ask and we don't push the doors. As we give thanks to God for all his goodness to us, I'm quite sure that God has got so many more great things for us, physically and spiritually. Just as I've shared this story with you, and it really touched me and challenged me to not think about just that one thing, not think of just going to this